You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we will take the necessary precautions for our nation's security and peace. Last night was the start of this, and we will keep going on the same way.
Turkey's Air Force strikes Islamic State inside Syria, and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan warns of more where that came from. My guests Robert Fox and Raffaello Pantucci will discuss this escalation of the conflict with IS and the day's other big stories, including the beginning of US Secretary of State John Kerry's attempt to sell the Iran deal back home. Might Congress prove harder to convince than the Ayatollahs? China prepares to host peace talks between Afghanistan's government and the Taliban. Can Beijing succeed as a broker where so many others have failed? And as President Barack Obama stows his tray table and returns his seat on Air Force One to the upright position in preparation for touchdown in Nairobi, his hosts demand that CNN apologize for its typically sensitive and nuanced reporting of Kenya. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Robert Fox, Defence Correspondent of the Evening Standard. Welcome both back to the show. Now, as we were just hearing, Turkey has confirmed that its Air Force has, for the first time, carried out airstrikes against Islamic State targets, rather, inside Syria. The raids follow Monday's IS suicide bombing of an activist meeting in Suruç, which killed 32 people, and an exchange of fire across the border yesterday, which killed one Turkish soldier. In a related development, Ankara has also granted the United States permission to launch raids against IS from its vast air force base at Incirlik. Robert Fox, first, it's been said a lot and in tones of increasing vexation from the West, certainly, that Turkey has rather sat this conflict out so far. Do you get the impression Erdogan was waiting for a kind of cue to get involved, or has he been pushed into it?
I think he's moved with circumstances, because I think you're absolutely right that Turkey does not follow a Western agenda led from Washington or even further west than the United States. And I think we've got to get that absolutely straight. They have always been, this is Erdogan, Erdogan's Ankara has been very ambivalent about what has been going on in Kobani, because they are very wary of the quite successful operations by the local Kurdish forces of the YGM, formerly PKK, and they see them as greatly as Turkey's enemy. But I think Suruç really did change all this. The canard has been, with some justification, that the Turkish authorities have been quite glad to see these people crossing the border in quite large numbers from Turkey to join IS, ISIL, Daesh forces, whatever you call them, not perceiving them as a threat, better exported. Is there a bit of Sunni solidarity? Well, all that's now blown apart. The most significant part of your introduction, if I may say so, Andrew, is that they've opened up Incirlik, because it no longer can do, the United States and its allies, including UK and France, can no longer do sort of pinprick stuff, long range from Cyprus, from aircraft carrier decks. They can actually mount big attacks.
Because I think I'm right in recalling they refused to let the US fly out of Incirlik in the Iraq invasion, didn't they?
Yes, and they've refused quite consistently this time too, and now it's a game changer. And we have to ask, and it's not in Occidental NATO terms that they're seeing it, why Ankara now sees this as a big one, as a real problem.
Raffaello, Ankara now clearly does see it as a problem, or at least it's been drawn to their attention in the most brutal terms imaginable, that IS is a problem inside Turkey. Mm. Is it possible to gauge how much of a problem it is inside Turkey? The question I guess I'm asking is there any understanding of how much actual sympathy Islamic State may have inside Turkey?
Well, I mean, I think putting an exact figure on it is probably very difficult. And frankly, I wouldn't trust anyone who reliably thinks that they do, you know. But what I would say is that We know that the Turks have actually been clamping down for a little while. This sort of has been something that's been building up to. A few weeks ago, they had a whole series of arrests, which was seemingly targeted at sort of facilitation networks that ISIS was running in the country. It also, I would point out, isn't actually the first attack we've seen in Turkey that's had links back across the border, specifically to ISIS. We forget, but back in January, a woman blew herself up in Sultanahmet, which is the middle of Istanbul, sort of tourist area. And she had been someone who was the widow of a foreign fighter who'd been fighting with ISIS in Syria, and she'd come back from there with a bomb exactly, and there was a whole network around her that the Turks subsequently disrupted. So we know that there are networks going back and forth. We know that ISIS draws a lot of its money from managing to smuggle stuff out, which is then selling on the market. So there is a sort of strong network that's moving back and forth. What's unclear to me is whether what we're seeing now is a really definitive break, because at the end of the day, these networks must be fairly substantial, frankly, because, you know, of the amount of people we know who are going back and forth, because the amount of money the group's obviously making from selling stuff in the markets, from just the access that they really have. And the question becomes, if all of those are suddenly turned around, that could cause Turkey a lot of trouble. But then again, it also would cause ISIS a lot of trouble as well, because they do seemingly need these kind of networks to continue to operate, to be able to sort of get money and continue to sort of function. So I question whether we really are seeing a breaking point here, or whether there's a sort of a ratcheting up of tensions, and whether this is going to be kind of the end of the capability of, you know, groups like ISIS or others to sort of go back and forth across that border.
Robert, you alluded there to one of the subplots of this, which has basically been Erdogan trying to figure out which of Islamic State and local Kurds he dislikes most or likes least. There has been it struck me as a very peculiar response earlier this week. The PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, killed Turkish police in what they claimed was revenge for Ankara's collaboration with Islamic State. If Turkey is going to step up the conflict against Islamic State, where does that leave Turkey's relationship with the Kurds? Are they now enemies who are becoming friends again?
Difficult. I don't think they, and Rafael probably knows much more about this than I do from sort of granular individual details, but it is, I don't want to use a Cameronian phrase, as in D. Cameron of UK, existential threat, whatever the hell that means, but it's a big enemy, the PKK. It's a big war that they've been having. It dwarfs something like the British problems over 30 years with Northern Ireland. And both of you are absolutely right, is that, yes, you can see a step change. And I think Incirlik is a step change, but it is not a change in the weather. That they still see the Kurds as a threat. I think Erdogan himself is in difficulty over this. He's in difficulty domestically with his electorate. He got a bit of a bloody nose the last time around. He isn't much loved by his military for obvious reasons. So how are you going to figure out a reasonable security policy? Because I think there was a kind of, if I can put it like this, Danegeld policy. As far as I can make out, and Raffaello can correct me with this, that they were quite pleased to see these women with families from big conurbations, Ankara and Istanbul included, just to go off and join the ISIS cause, thinking it was going to be no problem to them. Because it's the thing is, you know, I can export the threat of the Danes and the Vikings to use the Danegeld thing by paying them off, as it were, in one way or another, and they won't come home. What I do think from what Rafael has been saying is that it is imported, it's coming into them. But can I just draw breath here that what I find so difficult, and I've been talking to very good British experts about this, we're still baffled about the nature of the Islamic State. Because if you read Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Financial Times, just to give you a roster of papers, just look at them over the past 10 days or a fortnight, you will get a completely different depiction from whatever day or week you choose of this. Is it a state? Yes, in a funny way, it does seem to be a state in its heartland, but not the kind of state that you would get joining the EU. It's not like Luxembourg, for example.
It's really not like Luxembourg.
Is it a movement? Is it like PASOK? Well, sort of it is. And is it a criminal syndicate? The most interesting thing that, as Raffaele has been saying, It does require financial instruments, and it knows how to use them. It does need taxation at home. It does need to operate in the market. It does seem to recognise, how the wheels of commerce work, particularly in the grey and the black economy. And that's why, I hope I'm not going too far ahead here, this is why their apocalyptic view, the Manichaean view of black and white, that all out there is in the realm of darkness, doesn't really work. Actually, they've joined the real and very dirty world.
Okay, well, we should move along now to Washington. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry may now be reflecting that securing a nuclear arms control deal with his country's bitterest enemy was the easy part. Yesterday, he appeared before some of his former U.S. Senate colleagues on the Committee on Foreign Relations to begin selling the deal to Congress. They proved a rather tough crowd, telling Kerry that he had been not only fleeced, but bamboozled. And today, Mitt Romney, you remember, unleashed a thunderous op-ed in the Wall Street Journal accusing the Iranian regime of being theocratic fanatics. Arguably a bit rich coming from him. But anyway, Raffaello, fleeced and bamboozled. I, for one, was pleased to see the word bamboozled appearing in headlines.
Always a pleasure.
Are they making legitimate complaints here, or are they just indulging in a bit of knockabout name-calling, looking for a headline?
Look, what I love about it is the fact that you point out that, you know, they're thundering about theocrats, and then Mitt Romney opens his op-ed talking about when Moses, with the Ten Commandments, God says.
Yeah,
I mean, come on, this is a reaction from the other end of the Bible.
I commend our listeners to Mitt Romney's op-ed. He does read rather like he's been out in the sun without a hat on.
Yeah. America hating, Israel denying, theocratic fanatics
exactly.
Who will use a bomb.
Well, suicidal, apocalypse seeking.
We will talk about this probably about as much as we need to talk about it. Does anybody at this point, Robert, I'll ask you, actually care what Mitt Romney thinks about anything?
Not he himself. It's what he is symptom of, and it is very, very worrying indeed. Because how much does Mitt Romney really know about Iran? How much does he know about the nuclear race? Is this playing to AIPAC? It's really, we are seeing an implosion of global understanding across the spectrum of congressional politics in this. And this is why, you know, Obama, intellectual, slightly laid back, not remote, is trying to think it through. He's trying to think it through with Kerry, and I think Kerry has done a good job here because he's engaged. Mm. This kind of thunderous posturing, if I could, can you posture thunderously? But I suppose
I think so.
Oh, come on, you must have seen those old Renaissance paintings with the gods waving down at us all.
I think that is a permissible conjunction of verb and adverb.
What's going on, and it's great for American knockabout, and it's great for American journalism, and it's dreadful for the rest of the world.
There were some very odd things said, I thought, yesterday, Raffaello. Mm. Senator Marco Rubio, a Florida Republican running for president. As are a growing number of Americans, of course.
Is any Republican not running for president?
Well, exactly. That's the point. I mean, this whole thing is basically a bunch of people posturing for their next sort of administration trying to play to their base.
At this point, I'm not altogether certain I'm not running for president. but Senator Rubio said, this struck me as a very odd thing to say, he said the next president is under no legal or moral obligation to live up to it. Now, that's not really how international treaties work, is it?
No, it's really not. And it's, I mean, if one thinks logically about what he's essentially saying that, you know, it doesn't matter what agreements you sign with our government now, because in 4 years we're going to scrap them anyway. And so no one will ever trust an American government again, because you'll never know whether it's going to last, whether there's any point to this. This is so clearly sort of a race to the bottom by Republican politicians who are desperate to attract more attention, because there are, what, 16 of them now running on the one side?
One more's joined today.
There we go, 17 different candidates. You got to get it down to one, and you got to make yourself heard. You got to make yourself loud. And you're competing against Donald Trump's hair, which is, you know, quite a feat in itself. So the louder, the more dramatic you make it, the more extreme you go. You know, one would hope optimistically that even if they win, even if they get into power, they can never live up to these sorts of statements, because there are such things as legal binding agreements that countries sign. But at the same time, the fact that you've got people shouting this narrative, if he was to go far, win in the campaign, which I personally don't think Rubio is going to swing it. But, you know, were he to do that, others would immediately point back to those comments at any agreement that he's trying to sign and say, well, how do we know that this is going to hold 4 years? So what's the point of really even talking to you?
Kerry did say in the middle, amid the wigging he got from the committee, that it was fantasy, as he put it, to say that the US could have held out for a better deal. Is that kind of an admission that Tehran was in a position to dictate terms, though, Robert?
Tehran has got its ducks in a row in a way that it hasn't before. And Andrew, you and I, and I think with Rafael, we've discussed it on this program. Zarif and Rouhani, in talkers and negotiators, are a class act. Mm-hmm. And that has been consistently underestimated. The fact that they're absolutely fluent in English is so important. They are prime intellectuals. They're at least as intellectual as Mr. Obama. They're all very, very clever people. Mr. Obama's a very clever person. And they engaged. They knew what the game was. And it's very attractive to somebody like John Kerry. You're talking to reasonable human beings. Mm. You may think they get a Welsh and weasel and goodness knows what.
And it must be a genuinely refreshing change from attempting to deal with Ahmadinejad.
Yes. Yeah, and Zarif and Rouhani are fascinating because they're interlocutors. They're interlocutors with the P5 plus one, they're negotiators, and they're interlocutors with the Ayatollahs. And up to now, they've done a pretty interesting job. As I have written in my editorials consistently now, this is a triumph. If you believed in diplomacy, so far this is a triumph for diplomacy because it's how it should work, whether you get the result desired at the end. But I'm saying that it's what they're doing. At his very best, it's something that Machiavelli would recognise. And that these are very, very clever people. And I think, to use with an Italian, they are di buon cuore. I think these people really do wish it well. They don't want a bad result.
Final thought from you on this, Rafael?
Well, I was just going to add one point, which is that here we're focusing very much on the American conversation, and it's predictably in the public eye and very noisy and amusing in many ways. But actually, I think there's a question of what this means back in Iran and how this is playing into the domestic political scene there, absolutely. And what the conservatives are doing versus the reformers. I think there's something very interesting happening there that really isn't getting the attention. And actually, it's going to be a pretty difficult sale there as well. You know, I mean, here we'll hear all about it, but what happens in Iran, well, I don't know necessarily get out there.
It's a very big moment in Iran it's the transition from the revolutionary generation.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Rafael Pantucci and Robert Fox. Coming up next, could China be the host and or broker of an Afghan peace deal? And should CNN apologize to Kenya?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city. You know, it's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And you're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Rafael Pantucci and Robert Fox. Now, the idea of China brokering a peace deal in Afghanistan may seem at first glance unlikely. On further scrutiny, it makes a reasonable measure of sense. It's certainly closer to Afghanistan than the United States or the EU. It possesses considerable diplomatic, military and economic heft, and it has an interest stopping any Islamist insurgency a long way short of its far west Xinjiang region, itself home to a sputtering jihad, and possibly not coincidentally, the location of Afghan peace talks scheduled to start next week. Rafaela, first of all, how seriously will the Afghan government or the Taliban take China as an interlocutor here?
Very seriously. And I think they have for some time. From the Afghans' perspective, you know, the bane of their life is Pakistan, quite frankly. And they realize that Pakistan's one great ally and the one that the Pakistanis actually listen to is Beijing. So from an Afghan perspective, this sounds like the perfect sort of partner. And I think it's very significant with these particular talks, which is something that the Chinese have been alluding to for some time. They actually had a round of them in Urumqi, I think it was earlier this year. And then they had this meeting in Peshawar, which I think was an extension of that. And this is kind of the next leg of that visit. What's really significant about them is, unlike the debates in Qatar, where I think the Afghans, frankly, didn't necessarily hold a lot of water with the guys who were there, basically saw them as mouthpieces who weren't able to do anything or make any decisions until the Shura back home told them. The guys they're talking to here are the guys who are connected up in Pakistan, who they perceive as really the ones who are speaking for the sort of Taliban insurgency.
Robert, what are the Taliban after here? Do they actually want peace or do they want diplomatic cover for war?
Well, I want to follow what Rafael said. I think it's very important, and you've got a buy-in from Mullah Omar and the Quetta Shura here, which is very, very important indeed. I think they're desperate, funnily enough. Let me explain that. By the way, can I ask you, answer the question that you asked, Rafael? It's absolutely clear to me as to why China is in this. Have you ever been, rhetorical, to Mezanac?
Yes.
I have. Mm-hmm. Have you? The great copper mine, which is China. China has big investments in Afghanistan. They bought iron ore mines, coal mines. They're small, but a whole it's measles if you look at the map. And they're very, very keen on this. And they're also looking at REE, rare earth elements. It is economically strategic to them. I am not surprised that China is now involved in this. Back to the question you asked me now. The thing is, why do I say the Taliban are desperate? It's because there are pressures coming from the northeast. Ahmed Rashid has been writing very interestingly and eloquently about this. He's been up to Tajikistan, where you're getting a new formation of insurgents who are aimed partly at Afghanistan, but partly at the secular former republics of the Soviet Union. It's an unholy alliance between elements old and new. The IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, is very prominent in it, but there are also new IS elements. What these IS elements are, I think we have to examine and parse, and they come from all over the place. The one thing that IS can command, and it should come up, a bit in our Turkish reply, is that they have hardened mercenaries. They have very good fighters that go around the world. And these people crop up all over the place. Chechens, and goodness knows what. They're in Ukraine. They're certainly in the Caucasus, and they're certainly appearing in Tajikistan at the moment. It is beginning to split the Taliban, this movement, because some Taliban elements are going over to this new confederation, and some elements of the Taliban are against. Hence, sorry, rather long-winded, answer to your question. For survival, the southern lot from Pashtunistan really do realise they've got to throw in their lot with Kabul now. Kabul, it's prosperous, but the security situation is absolutely crumbling, and they realise now is the time. Otherwise, they may miss it altogether.
Rafaela, a final thought on this one. What domestic political signal is China attempting to send by convening these talks in Xinjiang?
I don't know if there necessarily is a domestic message within this, to be honest with you. I think that the message is, the Chinese, they've always been very open about these discussions. They've said, you know, we're not saying we can, you know, bring peace, but we can offer a place where you can discuss and we can offer all those sorts of things, a platform for these sorts of discussions. And, you know, it makes sense in many different ways. The Chinese are at the moment in this big push, this one belt, one road, Yidaoyilu, which is going out in all these directions. And Afghanistan, if it goes really bad, has the potential to cause a lot of trouble to a lot of these trade links that they're developing going out westward. And they have got a big problem in their western province of Xinjiang. And from a Chinese government perspective, they need to develop the economy of that region. Well, this region is very far from any seas in China. So frankly, developing connections out into Central Asia, be it Afghanistan, Pakistan, or the Five Stans, makes sense because that's where you're really going to be able to get access to markets. It's where you're really going to be able to develop into. So it makes sense domestically from that perspective. But frankly, the signaling here is much more in some ways about China's, you know, growing tentative role as a sort of global power, if you will.
Okay, well, if all has gone according to schedule, and it has gone according to schedule, while we have been on air, Air Force One has touched down at Jomo Kenyatta Airport in Nairobi, beginning Barack Obama's first visit as president to the country of his father's birth. He may find himself, upon arrival, asked to take sides in a row between his host and American news network CNN, which earlier this week expressed concern about Obama visiting what it tactfully called a hotbed of terror. Kenya is seeking an apology. Robert, this is just CNN being CNN, isn't it? Should Kenya just let this one go?
I think Obama is intelligent enough to let this one go. It is, am I allowed to say this? It's CNN being at its daft worst. Really, if you are a news organisation,
you don't go around self-protection and protesting your own view of the world. Mm. I mean, even for all its problems, and very brave people that they have working on, the BBC wouldn't dream of doing this. I mean, whatever the faults of the BBC are, it is simply mad to have done this journalistic terms.
It is funny, though, and I just wonder if it does tap into there's a wider thing here about the way the Western media still covers Africa. I can remember seeing a story on the BBC last year which made reference to, and I quote, far away Nigeria. Hmm. I mean, it's closer than the west coast of the United States. You wouldn't have a BBC reporter saying they were in far away California.
There is a great problem with the culture of international journalism. Now, not being a great linguist myself, but I do speak one or two foreign languages, how few international correspondents in the Anglo-Saxon world, I don't know whether Raphael would agree with me, I mean, I speak his language of his father very, very happily and very joyously, it's a colossal problem, because if you don't speak languages, you don't get into the mentality. I mean, the BBC's coverage, just to praise it, of the Hezbollah war was absolutely outstanding, because you had two outstanding correspondents who were fluent Arabic speakers, Jim Muir and Kim Khatas, who is Lebanese. This is the thing that's going wrong. And this is, I mean, I'm sorry, and I've quoted him now two broadcasts in a row. It's Edward Said. It's this kind of Orientalism, this sort of romantic imagination. And this is why CNN, it's deranged as an objective news broadcasting organisation to put out this kind of warning. Yes, you protect your people, but to have used an editorial line like that, I think the president, great respect, is wise enough just to keep quiet about it.
This is a tricky visit for President Obama, though, Raffaello. How enthused do you think he really is about being photographed shaking hands with Uhuru Kenyatta, recently discharged of war crimes accusations in somewhat dubious circumstances?
Well, it is funny, because when you look at the coverage, the line clearly that the Obama administration was eager to push before he went was the fact he was going to this entrepreneurs conference, and it was much more about economics and we're going to help Africa grow and all these sorts of things. And yet the stories have been guided, one, by this rather awkward CNN coverage, the reality that in fact there is a substantial counterterrorism problem in Kenya, but it's nowhere near this sort of hotbed of terrorism that CNN was talking about. And so now this question about the leaders that he's going to meet, and there's sort of a bit of, I don't know, it's not very clear and not very positive. It's not the image, clearly, that he wanted to go back to the homeland to be sort of returning to Kenya victorious to help the local entrepreneurs develop. It's turning into a very messy sort of story. To be honest, friends in Nairobi said that they weren't really worried about the terrorism. They were more worried about all the traffic that was going to engender from this.
It was difficult for him.
Or a lack of traffic, given the number of roads that will be closed in his honour. Finally and briefly tonight, with our last couple of minutes. Yesterday, the Financial Times ended 127 years, if I've done the maths right, of British ownership when its publisher Pearson sold the title to Japanese media firm Nikkei for £844 million. A brief thought from each of you on this. Robert, first of all, is the FT in safe hands, do we think?
It's going to be very different. I think it's overpriced, and it shows you the dilemma of very British-based journalism purporting to be global.
Mm. We did see on the subject of it being British a slightly peculiar reaction from The Guardian this morning. Not a paper, I think it's fair to say, given to jingoistic flag waving, but it is doing that on its masthead. You've got it over there, Raffaello, saying British based, British owned, your quality newspaper.
Then underneath it says FT sold, page 7.
Yeah, I mean, which is all good Fleet Street in crowd knockabout stuff. Did that surprise you?
I mean, it surprised me to see it on The Guardian, to be honest. I read The Guardian online, so I hadn't seen the hard copy yet, but it does surprise me a little bit. But I think Robert's right about what this means for sort of British newspapers going international. I wonder about another aspect of this, in fact, which is a curious thing about a person. I'm a person who reads the FT on an iPad every day, and it comes from an app which is actually web-based rather than Apple-based. So they don't actually do it through the company Apple, because obviously they find it more profitable. I wonder if that's going to change. It makes using the app a little bit more complicated, a little bit more awkward, but I wonder if that's something that will resonate out of this. I've no idea.
And it's a bit slow.
It is a bit slow, isn't it? You have to download it all the time.
I will take the word of both of you for that. I still barely understand what an app actually is. We will have to leave it there. Raffaello Pantucci, Robert Fox, thank you very much as ever for joining us on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Mariana Zuniga, Melkon Chachogli, and Eugenia Elenskaya. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Tom Edwards will be here to keep you company with Monocle's International Playlist. Marcus Hippie, who just produced this, follows at 1900 London time with The Menu. At 2200, I'm back for the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. For this edition, it's goodbye. Have a good weekend and thanks for listening.